This is Anthony Iannarino, and you're listening to In the Arena. Step into the arena. Give it all that you got. Into the arena.
It's time to make it your best shot. Chase the dream and break the scene. Your opportunity is right here. It's right here. It's right now. Welcome to my arena.
This is a difficult interview to set up. John Robb has a very varied background, so he's difficult to describe. He has a military background, having been in special forces and working in Iraq. He worked for Forrester as the first internet analyst, and then he built a number of businesses, one using technology in the financial industry that just sold for something close to $300 million. I found John because I hang around on the outskirts of a group of people that study fourth generation warfare, and it's essentially about how smaller organizations are able to defeat larger organizations. And that led me to John's book, Brave New War, which for my money is more eye-opening and probably more enlightening than, say, Thomas Friedman's The World is Flat. John now is focused on building resilient communities, and you can find his site at resilientcommunities.com. I put links in the show notes here. I asked John to come on to talk about being a red team player, which means thinking like an underdog. I asked him to share his ideas about super empowered groups. We chat about this disruptive age and how the legacy systems and structures are struggling to deal with the technological changes and keeping up with societal changes. And we also talk about networked resilient communities and their importance in the way we organize our lives and our businesses in the future. So hang in there on this one. It's a lot to think about. It's a lot to take in, and it will give you pause as you think about all kinds of things.
Hey, John, how are you?
Doing great.
Thanks for being here. And I'll just go ahead and admit my embarrassment that I'm in the middle of no electricity and you are a resilient community guy with probably redundant power to the nth degree. So I found your work through the fourth generation warfare community, Chet Richards and that group. And I read your book, Brave New War. I was blown away by the implications of what you wrote then. And then I found my way to Global Guerrillas, your blog, and I honestly haven't slept nearly as well since I started reading you, even though you describe yourself as an optimist. Can you give people listening to this a short version of your background?
Okay. It's a pretty varied background, but that's more common today than not. I was a pilot, astronautical engineer, Tier 1 Special Ops, worked with Delta and SEAL Team 6 on counterterrorism for a long while. And then I got out of the military, got a management degree at Yale, and went on to be the first internet analyst at Forrester Research. And then I, after that, I went to run a company called Userland Software, and we did a lot of the early blogging technology, including RSS, and it's really simple syndication. And that kind of networked blog infrastructure ended up becoming Twitter and ended up becoming Facebook and the like. So, you know, the same techniques were all used and the technologies were all used in building those systems. Back when we started, there was like maybe 100 blogs. And, I was one of the top 50. So it was kind of very strange. I got into the blogging from that. And, 9/11 happened and all sorts of things are going on in terms of the coverage of the war and particularly the war in Iraq. And I was dissatisfied with the explanation for what was happening. And, I saw something, much different based on my experience in special ops, as well as, my experience with technology and how technology was impacting organizations. So I, created a blog, Global Guerrillas, and started doing analysis of events as they were occurring and trying to, build a new kind of model for unconventional warfare or guerrilla warfare. And over time, it became pretty popular. and a lot of people were reading it, and they were asking for something a little bit more formal, and I ended up writing a Brave New War, which did pretty good for a nonfiction book about warfare, particularly guerrilla warfare. And a lot of people read it, liked it, all the way up from the CIA, NSA, all over the DOD. I end up, you know, being the kind of guy who was doing all that kind of consulting for many years. And you know, what fell out of it was this idea of open source warfare and system disruption as the main form of attack. And open source warfare is this idea that lots of small groups, each with their own motivations for fighting or for doing damage to a nation state or to a community, can, you know, operate together as a whole, even if they don't even if they disagree with each other, and that this form of cooperation can yield, you know, very rapid rates of innovation and improvement in how they attack an enemy. And we saw that in Iraq, where you know, every time we tried to come up with a way of defeating IEDs, you know, with our $3 billion countermeasure program, we rolled out a solution. You know, 2-3 weeks later, the this open source community of 70 to 100 different Iraqi groups came up with a solution and then shared it to defeat our countermeasures. So it ended up being a kind of a more accurate explanation for, you know, how things operated in Iraq, where there were, you know, 70 or so groups, each with a different motivation. Some were a bunch of different flavors of jihadis, lots of different nationalist types, some Baathists that like Saddam, some that didn't.
And what you wrote, sort of broke the paradigm, though, right? I mean, the paradigm is that we deal with states. And your book suggests you're not dealing with the state, you're dealing with these individual groups. And if you treat it like you're dealing with the state, you're automatically not going to be able to get that resolve, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I don't think people really appreciate the fact that, you know, ideology is dead. I mean, true ideology. The thing that, you know, the kind of motivating, you know, common thread that can, and you know, bring together hundreds of millions of people. You know, we're fragmenting. Our ideas are fragmenting. I mean, even in the Islamic movement, there's, you know, thousands of different threads going on. in Christianity and ideas in regards to how the government should operate in the United States. You know, socialism is dead as an ideology. Communism is dead as an ideology. Even free market thinking, I mean, it's all over the map now. There's no like singular ideology that can hold people together anymore, and that is expressed in warfare too.
And it's interesting, and this is why I asked you to be on this podcast. So I write about sales and leadership in business, but you are also, in addition to being a self-described optimist, you're also a red team player. And I wondered if I could get you to talk a little about what is a red team player. And what are the attributes that allow someone to think and behave like one? And I'm sort of thinking about this from a business perspective, because we've had this idea, it's hard to compete against a bigger company. It's harder to defeat a bigger entity. And my experience is that I've always found it easier to do that. And I think that things are leading to the point where it's going to be easier and easier to do that with the right sort of a mindset. Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. I'm just a natural red team player. That's just how I
a little contrarian.
Well, you know, it's just the way I am. The way I, you know, ever since I was a kid, you know, I was always on, you know, trying to pick the opposite side, the underdog's position, and that's the, you know, the way I think. And it worked well for me when I got into special ops, because, you know, effectively I was a smuggler, and my job was to, you know, get a team across the map without getting caught or getting shot at before the op began, right? And, you know, you have to, you know, be resourceful and you know, operate against a larger foe. in a way that allows you to succeed even though the odds are stacked against you. So it played also well for me when I became a, you know, an entrepreneur, when I was building companies from the ground up. You know, entrepreneurs have to be red team players. I mean, you're playing against the market, playing against established players. Like you, I think it's much easier to, it's very easy to compete against a big player. You just have to figure out how to do it. And
you use the word resourcefulness, and I have that on my list of attributes as well. That's the attribute of all attributes. It's, can we find a way?
Right.
And big players are more constrained, right, by system and process. And as a red team player, you're not constrained by any kind of rules or doctrine. Is that a way to say that?
Oh, yeah, that's one way to say it. You know, they move slower. They typically only have, you know, one path of development. Whereas you with a bunch of other competitors can have, you know, each have their own. You can have multiple development paths. You can try lots of different things and, you know, switch it on a dime. You can be more flexible, more nimble. And also you can live in smaller, you know, submarkets or niches, in places where the bigger player can't live. You know, one of the success points of the Mittelstand. Have you ever heard of the Mittelstand?
Oh, sure. So it's the German sort of mid-sized business segment over there.
Yeah, and I have a kind of a remote German cousin who runs a Mittelstand company in Germany, and the philosophy there, you know, talking to him and actually reading about the, you know, Mittelstand, is that you want to find a niche. You know, it's a family-run business typically. It's a business that lasts forever. They don't take on much debt, but they find a niche and then they, you know, stay abreast of everything that's going to impact that niche and continually respond to it. And they stay small. And they stay small intentionally in order to avoid getting too slow or getting too big to, you know, respond to the changes in the environment. And being in a niche, and if you do it well, then, you know, you can be very prosperous and have a great life. But if you're in, you know, working for a company that wants to grow very big, which is kind of like an American disease of sorts, you can take on a bigger foe by turning their strengths into weaknesses. You know, doing things they can't. So, for instance, I was thinking about this in regards to other stuff I'm doing in terms of building local businesses that compete with, you know, global or national businesses, and in agriculture and food production. And what I'm doing with these, you know, local community-supported agriculture farms is that getting them to think of food or producing food as a service rather than a commodity. And by thinking of it as a service, you know, where you're sharing the experience of actually producing the food that is, responding to customer needs in a way that these big supermarkets or industrial agriculture can't do. I mean, they can't share the experience with you because it's being produced off in the middle of nowhere and then shipped thousands of miles, you know, before it ends up on your plate. You don't want to compete with them, you know, head to head, you know, on a commodity basis, on a price basis. That'll kill you. But you can compete in, you know, in terms of making it a service. You can compete in freshness. You can compete in
the fact that it's still actually food.
Yeah, you know, yeah. But those are harder arguments to make. But yes. I mean, you could even bring it to the point where you're actually growing the food on their yard, like taking a landscaping job and turning it into foodscaping, where the yard is actually a place where it's professionally managed food production that you participate with, and your kids can go out and actually pick the food right off the trees.
And this is a paradigm shift which you're good at, and I think you've said a couple things. So as a business person, and I've got a mid-sized business that's been in the family. I'm the second generation, and it's a great business, and I'm happy to be a part of it. And it is not quite as susceptible to fluctuations in the market because we are a niche. But there's so many businesses that I talk to and that I work with where they think that they have to be everything to everyone, and they think that they're supposed to be competing against giants. And sort of one of the questions I had for you that you answered is, a smaller, weaker organization to defeat a larger, stronger one, you know, you're picking this niche and you're saying, okay, I want to compete with you where scale doesn't matter anymore. I want to compete with you at this local level where service and experience and community and other things where I can compete and win count for more than scale, because what matters here locally is local, and that's something that you can control, and you can be the best. In your example there, you can be the best food supplier in this particular area, right? Rather than deciding that you're going to compete on price or something that a large scaled business would compete on.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. You can manage the environment to your advantage. It doesn't really matter the industry you're in. I mean, you can pick a niche and, you know, like this local bike company down in the Boston area called Seven Cycles. And they specialize on the creation of titanium bikes with titanium frames and that are, you know, built to the specifications of the buyer. I mean, you know, in terms of measuring your needs, or, you know, they'll build exactly the bike for you. And then they've moved very slowly into this niche, but they dominate it. They produce less than the market demands, just a little bit. They have 30 employees, and they very slowly shift to change their target market. They're, you know, not they. Looking at all the different competitors, they're looking at all the different materials, they're able to pay all their employees, you know, enough money to, you know, their machinists and everybody else, that they're enough money to actually allow them to buy a house. It's a different kind of approach to, you know, how to build a business than most people experience. A lot of people think in terms of the technology industry, and I've been there, I've been in the technology industry, but you know, that it has to be huge. It has to go, you know, fast as it possibly can.
I mean, and that's what you do at Forrester, right? I mean, it's how do we help these businesses grow and dominate that market? I mean, that's the main point of business for them, correct?
Forrester actually sold mostly into big businesses.
Right.
Established players. And the research industry, like a Forrester or any kind of research firm, that does market research, really is focused on trying to tell, you know, big businesses when it's safe to actually make a move to invest in a new technology, in Forrester's case. You don't want to be a leading edge, and you don't want to be behind. If you're on the leading edge or you're a little bit too early, it's going to cost you a lot of money. And if you're behind, it's going to cost you a lot of money. You just want to be right at the right moment, and you want to be aware of what's out there too. That's how they make their money, Ed.
Let me shift gears, and I come from a small company background. I've consulted with large companies, and I speak to large companies, but I see so much of effectiveness coming from individual players and small teams, and I wonder. In Brave New War, which I'll point people towards, I promise they'll have insomnia after they read it, but how does one become a super empowered group? Can you talk about super empowered groups and what those attributes are that allow you to generate sort of outsized results because of the way that an organization is structured and sort of that that maybe moral philosophy, if that might be a way to talk about that?
Yeah. One of the threads or one of the themes of Brave New War and a lot of my writing is that technology is making it possible for smaller and smaller groups to do more and more. I term that super empowerment. I mean, it's why, you know, open source warfare with all those very, very small groups that, you know, I'm talking about can actually be effective. You know, each small group can undertake attacks that do outsized damage. And the best way, if you're attacking, to you know, leverage your action is to attack a network, and attack a network in a way that causes the network to break down. or respond in a way that's detrimental to its long-term operation.
You want to share an example of that? Like, I know in the book you talk about pipelines, so people know what you're talking about when you...
Yeah, there's a classic example. You've probably never heard of it. It was an attack on a Mexican natural gas pipeline. You know, one bomb exploded and by a group that nobody had ever heard of and haven't heard of since because no one was caught. And it knocked out this natural gas pipeline for about a week. But that pipeline supplied all of the power, you know, through the plants that were using it to generate electricity for about 1,200 companies located on the border between the U.S. and Mexico, all those maquiladora companies.
Right.
And shut them down for a week. So it's about $2.5 billion worth of lost production.
At what kind of cost to pull that operation off?
I could be generous. $1,500, but you could probably have done it with a little bit of thermite, which is like really easy to put together. You know, you're not going for blast, you're just going for a hole in the pipeline and the rest will take care of itself. So, you know, we're talking, you know, rates of return in the millions, you know, an ROI, you know, measured in millions, 1,000,000%.
And what enables that Super Impounder Group? In part, it's technology.
Well, you can break that technology down into a lot of different categories. You can think of it in terms of networking to learn. So you can access this, you know, global internet of information and use that to spool up on what's possible and, you know, what to attack very, very quickly. You can get all the, like, for instance, those Boston bombers, they got all their information from on how to build the bombs that they built from a magazine called Inspire, which was produced out of Yemen. It's an electronic e-zine that produced by jihadis and their readers, their subscribers. But you can find out, you know, all the particulars you need from doing your research on the internet. You can also meet other people via the internet. You can network much more easily. That's a form of empowerment. Getting people together that normally wouldn't get together if you just, you know, were based on meeting or limited to meeting people only in your geographic location. And then you can use the leverage the network provides you in terms of, you know, amplifying your damage. And the pipeline was an example. But you can do it in information, too, by, you know, putting a rumor out there or doing something in the social sphere, you can have a significant damage that way too.
It's interesting to me about Super Empowered Groups. The technology is such a big piece of it because that technology is available, you know, now to all of us. So small business people, small communities that want to do something together now has this toolkit where we can find each other, number one, and where we can help each other, number two. And I know you've focused in the book and on Global Gorillas, the blog, on a lot of the risks that comes with. And I saw today that the government has taken down the 3D, you know, CAD CAM directions for 3D printing of a gun. And it's already popped up onto the BitTorrent sites. As quickly as it comes down, it goes back up someplace else. But also, and I'll do two more questions here with you, Juan, but I want to talk about moral cohesion, and then we'll talk about resilient communities. But sort of what you're doing with resilient communities, so it can be empowered for good as well. I mean, we can find each other. We can build communities, even though there's distance. And I look at your site, Resilient Communities, and I found other links. And there's a lot of communities of people who are like-minded that can find each other now and pop up and say, hey, we can handle problems and situations together. And we can find this community and build something around it and share this knowledge. And it looks like that's being done as much evil and bad as being done. It looks like there's as much good being done by Super Empowered Groups as well.
Right. That's the very, you know, thought process that led me to create Resilient Communities is that they're, you know, open source development is the counterpoint to open source warfare.
I will embed links in the show notes here, but before we do moral, this cohesion and the morale, I guess, or esprit de corps of super empowered groups, maybe we'll use resilient communities to talk about that. I'll put links there, but share with this group what a resilient community is and what your primary work is there now.
Sure. All my work on warfare and conflict and my time looking at technology led me to conclude that the world is becoming, you know, more unstable or, you know, disruptible. That we're going to see disruption after disruption in a lot of the major systems that we're relying on.
And remind me that you're an optimist when you say that.
Well, a lot of what we're seeing in terms of, you know, disruption is from, you know, the old industrial system, you know, based on bureaucracy and markets, you know, breaking down. And this is kind of big picture thinking on my part. But,
right. And it's the end of the industrial age. I'm calling it the disruptive age because it looks like one disruption.
Yeah.
With the next one coming.
Yeah. I think, though, you know, that a lot of people focus on markets and in bureaucracy, you know, the nation state. Bureaucracy, corporate bureaucracy, or markets. We apply markets to politics in using elections, and we use markets to allocate resources in financial markets and et cetera, are the be-all and end-all. But really, those are just organizational methods that were applied to solve the technological problems posed by industrial technology and the technologies of our age.
Right.
Now technology's moved on. It's created this global internet, global connection. You know, upwards of 5 billion people are connected now. Information is being shared in a lot of different ways. There's new organizational methods that are going to come to the fore over time. But, you know, we're caught in this transition period where the old system has reached global scale and it's not doing so well. It's not scaling well. And the places where it's showing wear and tear is like it, in the environmental area with the climate change, you know, trying to bring, you know, an extra 2 billion people in China and India onto, you know, up to U.S. and Europe's consumption levels is not going to work out well for anyone. The financial system has ended up becoming, you know, a real mess with all of its derivatives and I studied the trade derivatives at one point, so I understand them as much as the next guy, but I understand that nobody understands them. Mainly because we just don't have any kind of experience with a system this complex. We don't have any data set to base any projections of stability or, you know, what can happen with it. So when you get guys like, you know, the CFO of Goldman Sachs saying, you know, the last crash was a 1 in 10,000 year event, you know, based on what data set?
Yeah.
There isn't any data set to even make that, you know, we've only been doing it, you know, operating an economy at this level of complexity in the, you know, 20 years or so. So we're flying blind.
I see in the job market, too. I see people being taught and trained and prepared to work in an economy that doesn't exist in this way, with jobs that don't exist anymore.
Oh, yeah. You know, you see all these folks getting geared up, going to college and trying to get that knowledge job. You know, trying to get that secure cubicle. And those jobs are globalized and they're getting scarcer and scarcer because, you know, a lot of those positions can be automated out of existence.
You're less safe there now than ever, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, it's the old system not working. One of the things that really, you know, shows the wear and tear in the system is that these new businesses like Google and Facebook, you know, the businesses that get the most value on the stock market, you know, industries of the future, well, they don't need that many people. You could run Google with just a couple thousand people. You could run Facebook with just a couple thousand. In fact, if you really cut it to the bare bones, and you could run it with just a couple hundred. It really is that automated. It doesn't really take much. And, you know, if those are the kinds of companies that were, you know, saying that's the future, well, then where are all these folks going to work? And where they work is, you know, my thinking was, you know, we have all this disruption of this old system not performing. It, you know, a lot of indicators that we're, you know, less well off now than we were back in 1980 in the U.S., and the same thing is in Europe with, you know, Spain has 40% unemployment, and every national government in the world except for a handful is, you know, running at a massive deficit. All these systems are starting to break down, and there will be a lot of instability as we go forward, you know, from the climate, from the economy, from the finance, from the, you know, on and on, and terrorism, of course. And the solution is to actually add resilience into the system, by making a lot of what we're relying upon a scale invariant. And what I mean by that is that you produce more of what you need at the local level. Unfortunately, all the technology that needed to do that, do it better than we did 100 years ago, is available. And the ability to share techniques and capabilities is now available.
That's a source of your optimism.
Oh, yeah. Well, I see this new system just on the edge of, you know, where we produce almost everything we consume at the local level. We have 3D printing that can produce in the next 20 years almost anything you can possibly imagine printing. I mean, they're talking molecular level in 20 years, actually placing molecules by molecule. And you'll be able to put that into a, you know, machine that can be in town or be in a neighborhood.
Do you think Ray Kurzweil's projections are correct? We're going to be able to do far more than we think with 3D printing and local and shared, you know, schematics to build essentially anything we would need?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if it's just Kurzweil. I mean, a lot of us have been talking about this for a long time. I built a company back in 2006 in the print industry. It was a company called Hubcast, and it's still growing. And what it did is it made it possible to share, you know, print files for high-end printing, marketing printing, like trifolds and product sheets. And you put it into the system, and it would allow you to print anywhere in the world. We had like 30 different cities. So you could print it in Singapore, you know, 100 units or 100 copies, or you can print 100 copies in Frankfurt. And it's very similar to the kind of systems that we're seeing develop now in 3D printing. So what you'll buy or actually trade for or collaborate on the construction of is the design of the product, and that you'll print it locally. And it will print in wood or faux wood, plastics, metals. They're already doing printing of 3D printing of metal parts, that titanium parts that end up in aircraft engines, probably one of the most demanding environments out there. It's, you know, this kind of stuff is going to be able to print, these printers are going to be able to handle just about anything. And then we see it on food and water harvesting and energy production. You know, solar panels in this last year just crossed into new territory where it's really plug easy in order to, you know, install them.
I hate that you said trade for, that the financial system is also part of the old established bureaucracies as well, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the financial system is a market system, and the market systems are simple hub and spoke networks, and hub and spoke networks don't scale well when you get up to, you know, billions of players, and they're too easy to scam. I mean, there aren't any national laws that have gone, or, you know, legal systems have gone international yet or gone global. And the only thing that, only a couple of things that actually have gone to a global level are the financial system and the internet. And the financial system, as we know and we've seen recently, is easy to manipulate. And you get guys changing, you know, banks collaborating to change the LIBOR and set rates at for financial swaps. You know, it's those are core system features, and they're manipulating. They're supposed to work based on market fundamentals, and they weren't.
But they're not.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me because you're describing with this idea of resilient communities sort of going backwards in time, but keeping the tools, but just moving from this giant scale down to a local scale, which is the way communities have really existed on planet Earth for most of our time as humans, right?
Yeah, but it's a market difference, market improvement.
Yeah.
It's not just a continuation of the kind of, you know, village politics
right,
100 years ago, you know, where everyone, you know, was very, very, you know, set in their ways and they weren't able to accept any change. You know, we've centralized and now we're going back to this decentralized model. And, you know, you're not decentralized in the old way, you're disconnected or like a, you know, survivalist. You're connected.
Super connected.
Super connected. You know, if you have a town where there's like or a community where there's a couple dozen entrepreneurs who are financed via Kickstarter, so they don't, you know, they've cut out the middlemen, cut out the banks and VCs, and they've gone straight to customers and pre-sold their product, and they're employing people locally to construct the product. Like MakerBot, for instance, is constructed in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah.
And they're building it locally. Well, that's, you know, those people, those entrepreneurs are supplying, you know, more jobs, more stable jobs than you would ever get from any big company that would come in.
Right.
And you know, complementing them are all the people providing, you know, local services. You know, everything from the foodscaping I mentioned earlier to, you know, help with water harvesting, energy production, you know, in terms of putting in panels and at the community level and manage them and maintaining them. There's a whole infrastructure here that's slowly being built out, but it offers a much more flexible and dynamic future.
But like a big scale, though, there's an ecosystem that follows, you know, that kind of growth, too, right?
Yeah, the kind of systems I see developing at the global scale are more P2P oriented. You know, the P2P systems tend to be able to scale to, you know, the billion player mark.
One last question. I love the idea of super empowered groups. I love the red team player. I'm the same way as a natural disposition. And when I look at small teams, I always see teams that outperform have some sort of esprit de corps, some moral cohesion, some unit cohesion. Is that a factor in red state players and these super empowered groups? There's sort of this belief system, and there's some sort of a shared idea that is enough to motivate and compel that group to win, something that binds them together. And that's me riffing on this. I wonder if that's your experience or if you have a different idea about that.
Yeah, teams matter. Teams are the essential building blocks of any business. Functional teams are critical to actually, you know, being successful in business, and I've always found that to be true. And it means that, you know, when you're hiring people, I mean, that's the most critical thing you can do as a business owner. You don't want to hire anyone that isn't like perfect. I mean, you should spend so much time vetting that person and making sure that person is the perfect person before you commit to them.
I wrote a blog post last week saying if hiring is easy, you're doing it wrong. It's the hardest part of our jobs.
Yeah, and you get veteran people now. You know, Elon Musk the other day. You know, the guy who does Tesla.
Tesla, and, sure.
PayPal. You know, he goes, well, it took him all this time that character matters more than talent.
Yeah.
You know, and of course it matters more than talent. If you don't have, I mean, I came out of the military, you know, out of the, you know, tier one special ops world, of course character is everything. Because character can carry you through the really tough times where, you know, talent can only get you so far. Talent's always like number two or three. It's, you know, your ability to fit within that team and be effective, it is everything. You know, there's no room right now for solo players. And, you know, I've seen the kids, like my kids, and, you know, they're all much more team-centric than we, you know, the kind of experience that we had when we grew up. They do all their work right now in school. And I'm luckily in a town that has one of the best school systems in the entire state or entire U.S. And they do everything collaboratively. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, and
We've got the whole American ideal that it's all rugged individualism, but it's always been rugged individualism with help, right?
Oh yeah, and the kids get it.
Yeah,
and, anyone under like 30 probably grew up in a more collaborative environment, and with like all the social software, everything is done on a group basis. They almost feel incomplete without working with friends in it or other people in a team.
Mine are in constant. They're constantly communicating with their friends, and we were always with friends too, but they do collaborate more naturally, I think, than we did when I was their age.
Yeah, and they also can do it online. And one of the biggest or the best ways to start a company now, and I've done it, but this is the thing that's lacking with lots of folks, is to do it online. And I built a lot of great software where the team I put together was spread out all over the globe, and we never met each other face to face. Like I had people in New Zealand interacting with people in the Philippines, interacting with people in Texas. Some guy was on a beach in Turkey, and this software was produced very, very quickly, high quality stuff. It was the best way to do it. But it takes a special type of person to be able to do it. Not everyone is, at least our age, has been able to make the transition to working in teams online.
Yeah.
And it's not just being able to work online, it's being able to work on a team online, being collaborative and being constantly interconnect.
The tools are allowing for that now more and more. I mean, we're doing this over Skype now. The only reason I don't have video on is because my power went out, and I'm afraid it will make the experience worse for listeners. But, it's easier and easier to do this, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, the tools are all there. I mean, some of the tools we were using back when we were doing Userland still haven't even made it out into the larger environment yet, haven't gone mainstream yet. I mean, all the collaborative tools are available. They're great. They work fantastically well. Except a lot of people just can't make the transition. And it would be much more effective. And a lot of what we were talking about in terms of resilience and resilient communities is a lot more people telecommuting and working from home.
Yeah.
And never, ever actually, traveling unless you actually are doing it for pleasure. Or occasional reset with team members that you're working with on an ongoing basis, but to do it on a to travel an hour and commute is nuts.
To sit in an office,
sit in a cubicle,
right?
That's absolutely nuts. And the kids today don't have to do that.
They shouldn't have to.
And the only reason you we're still doing it is just this like overhang, this legacy effect. This also changes, the way people are hired for the most part now is that they're, hired as interchangeable units. It's easy to, be less loyal to an employee that works from home.
I mean, and that's also a factor from the industrial age of, I want the cheapest labor and I want to be able to put any cog in here and produce the same thing. And, now I see the things going the other direction, and we appreciate craftsmanship and we appreciate good experiences, and you don't get that from that sort of paradigm, that industrial age. Everyone's replaceable, everyone's a cog.
Yeah, what the probably the best thing a salesperson can do right now or a marketing person can do to gain a competitive advantage going forward is to learn how to build a very loyal community for their product, for their company.
Yeah.
And not it's harder to do if you're big, but if you can do it on the small scale, with these companies that are going public or straight to success on Kickstarter, the biggest impediment, the only real impediment they have is the community. They need to build a community, and that community is what supports them. And I interviewed as part of my resilient communities, or I have a strategy service that I sell research as a kind of an adjunct to people who are really interested in building resilient communities. And I interviewed a company that had taken the Kickstarter model and applied it to their ongoing business. And that seems to be the kind of thing that we're going to see more and more. In that case, every time they came up with a new product, they then, you know, offered that product to their community. And if there were enough orders, then they made it. And it allowed them to do to build products at a fraction of the cost of, you know, it would be if it was at a retail establishment.
I've seen a number of tech players doing that on Kickstarter now.
Well, after Kickstarter. I mean, they took the whole model and applied it to everything they do.
Yeah.
And so that was like an integral or core part of everything they do. And this was in the fashion industry. And it was quite a cool way to reinvent the whole space. And it's building that community and managing it and growing it. Boy, if you can do that and keeping them happy. And I know people have been talking about communities in the past, but this is a little bit different.
Community as a business model.
Yeah, I mean, the community is everything. You know, if you've got a small business and, you know, you want to keep that business going for years and years and years, and then you know, you have 20 people, you know, working in that business, you know, you don't need that big of a community to actually make it successful long term, depending on the product. But, you know, more expensive products, you could have, you know, 5,000-10,000 people in your community, and that could be all it takes to keep that business going.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's like this is kind of a riff on the, you know, the 10,000 fans concept.
Right.
It is so true. If you and as we start to niche out, you know, we've reached a technological level where big businesses can't explore more than a fraction of all the potential in all these new technologies that are coming on board are made available. And it's incumbent upon, you know, all the rest of us, everybody in the entrepreneurial sphere, everyone building businesses to come up with the other, you know, 99% of the potential uses of these technologies in useful ways, in ways that people would pay for. And some will be on the, you know, high end of craftsmanship, and some will be on the, you know, very, very unusual use that's combining multiple technologies in a new synthetic way. And, you know, a lot of those markets could be small, but could be lucrative enough that you could work from home you know, fill that need ad infinitum. Or it could be so small that you piece together two or three or four different small products in different areas that end up yielding a, you know, an income stream that's more than enough to handle everything it takes to keep a small team going.
I could see more and more of that happening. I want to end here, but I want to point people at your site. So where should people go to learn more about you and Resilient Communities? You've got children operating in the background.
Yeah.
No problem.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
ResilientCommunities.com is the main site that I'm at, where I do most of my writing now. It's ResilientCommunitiesplural.com. And then I have Resilient Strategies, which is not so much a externally focused site, but that's where you get access to the research if you want it. I do a monthly report that covers the people technologies or you know, people tools and ideas about, you know, creating this, you know, networked resilient community. Everything from starting businesses at the local level all the way up through to just improving your house and making it more resilient.
And still at Global Gorillas?
Yeah, I do some at the Global Gorillas. I was talking a little bit recently about Bitcoin.
Yep.
And, you know, I see Bitcoin in a much different way than I guess a lot of people do. you know, I see it as potential to do all sorts of different things. And I wrote a little bit about that and a little bit about, you know, different things in drone technology and how, you know, that's going to transform warfare. I mean, already on the drone side, you know, more Air Force pilots are trained to do drones than fly airplanes now.
This is why I think you're a fascinating guy to read. I hate the fact that I believe that you're right, and I think that Brave New War, what you've written, has proven to be right. I think what you've written at Global Gorillas has proven to be right. I'm horrified that what you're doing at Resilient Communities is right, if the implications are that every, you know, all of the big structures come down because it irreversibly changes, you know, what we expect as a society. But I have a hunch that you're you're more right than wrong, and I'm more uncomfortable than I've ever been. thank you for that. But I'm glad that you're an optimist, and I do think that there's more good to come from it than harm.
Yeah, it's important not to be a binary thinker in regards to the old structures. I mean, I think the legacy structures are going to be there for a long time. Just like, you know, the old monarchy feudalism structures were around for years and years and years after, you know, market-based economics and you know, new dynamic forms of government were, you know, came onto the scene in Europe. So, these structures are still going to be here. They're just not performing like they used to. They're not giving us the rewards and benefits that we expect for the level of participation that we put in.
And we'll have some new paradigm replace it until something else comes along, huh?
Network resilient communities. I see all these great dynamic, globally networked systems on the edge of being created, and those things will go. I mean, they'll build very, very quickly. Like, I mean, a global reputation system on business. You could see how fast it could actually roll out.
Yeah.
Everything you do in business, everything you do, you know, as a person would yield a reputation number.
We're so transparent anyway.
Oh, but yeah, but imagine you could never be a nefarious. You couldn't cheat somebody without having it reflected.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the guys on, you know, in business today would get hammered. Anyone at the CEO level, I know. I mean, and I know lots. Anyone in finance, man, they wouldn't make it. You wouldn't be doing business. We've kind of gotten to the point where everything's just a transaction that goes away at the, you know, end of the transaction. You know, you do the business, you sign the deal, and then it's, you know, you don't assume anything other than what's written in the contract.
That's what I hate, and it's what I work against, that mentality.
Yeah, but there's going to be systems that make that possible, and I see them already starting to develop. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so many other ways of organizing things at a global level that are dynamic and fun. A lot more P2P, a lot more you and your community. You're dealing directly with them, and being able to manage that relationship and do that successfully is going to be a key going forward.
It's an awful lot to take in, I know. You can find more about John Robb at resilientcommunities.com or globalguerrillas.typepad.com. As always, you can find me at thesalesblog.com. When you get there, sign up for the newsletter. That's all I've got for you this week. I'll see you back here next week in the arena.